Connor Franta is a best-selling author. He's an entrepreneur who started several companies. He's an in-demand speaker. And at the heart of everything is his YouTube channel, which he's been operating since he was a teenager. He's 29 now. The channel has over 5 million subscribers for videos that are often just about Connor and his thoughts on things, updates on his life. This is from one of his most recent videos.
If I can tell you one thing, if I want you to learn one thing from this video, from this buffoonery, this clownery, be open to how bizarre it is just to be human. Welcome in new ideas, new experiences, new concepts. Open your arms to how funny it is to just be alive.
A lot of Connor's subscribers are young people who kind of grew up with him and watched as he became an adult. To get a read on Connor, I spoke with one of his fans.
Kate Mo, you are my daughter and you're home on a break from college.
I am. You are correct.
The idea of a YouTube celebrity is not of my generation.
Okay. So you know how you have, like, Keeping Up with the Kardashians and, like, all these reality shows? I view YouTube as something that is better for my ADHD, quicker, and we get to know more about their life.
Our guest on the show this week is Connor Franta.
Woohoo! Childhood.
So why is Connor Franta so successful at this? He's got millions of subscribers. He's built an empire. He's got best-selling books. He's started companies. And it all started from being a Minnesota teenager talking about his life. Why is he so popular? Why is he so good at this?
Well, John, let me tell you this.
My name is Dad.
Okay, well, Dad, John Dad. Connor Franta, he has a very artistic way of telling his story. He has a very, when you like read his books, it's like very nice poetry and you feel very at ease and calm. But also, when a YouTuber or the new term, Dad, is influencer.
Okay, he's so an influencer.
He is an influencer. So, and that's the same with all, like, social media stars.
So quote. You could be an Instagram star influencer. You could be a YouTube influencer.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you say Instagram influencer, TikTok influencer, all those things.
MySpace influencer.
Yeah, like Reddit influencer.
Friendster influencer.
Yeah, like Facebook.
Bulletin board.
Yeah, post-it note influencer. Sure. Anyway, when you like get into this groove and you're like, oh my gosh, I want to know more about their life, more than just these videos, and an influencer has like a book out, you're like, oh my gosh, this is a great outlet, and I get to know about them in a different way, in a different format.
Is part of it too that he's been doing this since he was, you know, a younger teenager, making what I believe would be called very cringy videos to look at today? He cringes. He makes videos cringing at his own videos.
Yes, and that's what we do.
And then we see him evolve and grow.
Exactly, John. John Dad. We have created, also, I will put a new word into your vocabulary today, okay, as I have already done so with influencer, and it is the word relatable. And you know the word relatable as, oh my gosh, like, I relate to that.
Yeah,
like,
I know that word.
I know, but, like, it's different. Oh. So it's like, you know, like, I need milk at the store. Oh my God, I need milk at the store too. So relatable.
Okay.
That's how you view it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because everyone needs milk, and that's so relatable to say.
Yeah, I relate to that because I go to stores to buy milk.
Exactly. He gets it. But anyway, relatable in the terms of YouTube and social media and Gen Z and millennial. Anyone below the age of 30 is coined as something that people have done that's really awkward and uncomfortable, but like you're like, oh, it's okay because I do that too. So it's like an example would be when people would do like peace sign near their face or whatever, you would be like, oh my God, but
that's out of style now.
That's out of style, but then you're like, that's so relatable because I did that. And then we go back into the YouTube like realm or whatever, and people are like, talking about very explicit details about their life and how they're so socially anxious. And just, I think anxiety is a very big tool in relatability. How people like frame videos and you're like, oh my God, I'm anxious like that too. We're so cool. And then you're like, I want to subscribe to them.
Relatable.
Relatable. Ha ha.
Influencer.
So, influencer. You're my relatable influencer.
So every episode I do, I say, it's depression mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here.
Okay.
Do you want to do your version?
Yeah. It's depression mode. I'm Kate Moe, and I'm glad you're here.
Connor Franta, welcome to Depression Mode.
Thank you for having me.
Where are you from originally?
I am from a little town in Minnesota. It's called La Crescent. La Crescent, Minnesota, south of Winona, Minnesota. It's population 4,000.
Okay.
Little slight synopsis.
Not far from La Crosse, Wisconsin, if
there
I'm not mistaken.
There you go. Someone always knows one of the ones around it, but they never know it.
I'm pretty certain I've driven through that town, but I have also never heard of that town.
Yes. We have one stoplight in the entire town, two gas stations, so it's very much a pop in for gas, go past it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Place. So naturally a springboard to YouTube stardom, you know.
Oh, I know. It only makes sense, right, that this happened, that I'm here right now.
The train is, and we'll get to that. We'll get to that development. But it's a mental health podcast, and you're doing so much great work on mental health advocacy. I presume it was in your childhood, I don't know for sure, but when in your life did you first start to notice that, hey, something is not quite lining up right in terms of my mental health?
In terms of my mental health, I noticed it very quickly with my sexuality, but in terms of my mental health, I think they kind of go hand in hand in a way. They go, or at least, you know, somewhat parallel or in tandem or some general geographic location around each other, like a planet and a moon. But I think along my journey of figuring out that I am gay, that created a mental health struggle, that process, that kind of like solidarity really created issues in my life because I didn't have anyone to talk to. I didn't have anyone to express that to. I didn't have a comfortable place to, I guess, explore myself. Therefore, I went inward, and being a young person in a small town, it can be incredibly terrifying and tragic to feel so singular.
Was it a self-loathing kind of thing? Were you in an environment where being gay was bad?
It's one of those things where I'm wondering if I've repressed it a lot or if I just wasn't aware of it. But I don't think necessarily I was in the worst environment. I mean, Minnesota is a blue state. It's very forward-thinking in terms of like Midwestern states, but there definitely weren't any openly gay kids in my high school or, you know, my middle school. I don't think my parents had any LGBTQ+ friends. So it really felt like I was the only one thinking about this in the entire world.
Mm. But you must have, you know, watched TV, movies. You must have been aware that gay people existed in the world.
I mean, you'd be surprised. At the time, it was like Ellen or nothing. Like, it was like, we got a blonde, but that's about it. And
we'll give you Ellen. That's all.
Yeah, well, you take it and you'll accept it and you'll like it. But other than that, I mean, I think with anything, the representation in the media at the time was purely, not negative, but it was like gay people were a joke. You know, they were the butt of the joke. They were some sort of little like dig at straight men in TV shows. There weren't many openly gay people in network television or studio films. And if they were, they were A, a stereotype, or B, again, they were comedic relief. So the times that you did see yourself, you're like, I don't even know if that's me, nor do I know if I want to be that. It was very confusing.
The sassy best friend, or the sassy, you know, the gay male best friend to the female lead character.
It's all we can be. It's our only trait. It's the only thing we can.
Right. You're going to, at the audition, they see how well you snap and say the word girl.
Oh, yeah. Our wrists need to be very mobile.
Yeah. So then if that isolation, that kind of feeling alone or feeling like, you know, incorrect or strange,
was that fanning a mental health problem that you think was already there, or was it creating a sense of depression, a sense of anxiety or trauma?
I really feel like it created it, but you know, it's a chicken or the egg situation. I can't really know, but I do. That's the only time that I remember it like really becoming prevalent in my life, is the more I got confused, the more anxious and depressed I seemed to become, until, you know, inevitably there's like a tipping point there of, what do I want to do? Do I want to be this way for the rest of my life, or do I want to figure a way out of it?
Yeah. How conscious was that thought process? Were you trying to work on something like that?
So I didn't come out until I was 20, 21. I can never remember, 20 or 21. So like pretty late in life for, I guess, like a millennial, or in terms of today's standards, not late in life in terms of like 3 decades ago. But there was like a whole tipping point at which, you know, the depression, the anxiety, the self-loathing got so bad that I knew it was all rooted in my sexuality. And that was my only option to try and fix all of it, was like, maybe if I start with this step and I allow myself to move forward here, the rest of it will figure itself out along the way. Little did I know, it did, but it took a long time. When you figure out you have a lot of baggage, it takes a long time to unpack and put away and organize those thoughts that took years for you to like come to.
Yeah. You're carrying the baggage in the overhead compartment, so to speak.
Oh my God. 4 carry-ons, yeah.
Were you clear to yourself that you were gay, but it was just a matter of not coming out? It was just like trying to stuff it down?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was clear to I think it was pretty clear I was gay, but at the same time, I had never even been given the freedom to explore. So there was a little bit of questioning there too. It was like gay questioning, could be, you know, bi questioning, who knows. But after I allowed myself to just indulge in the idea that maybe I am just like purely a homosexual, I'm a pure homosexual, then once I had like the liberation and the freedom that followed that, I thought, oh, it doesn't even matter if I don't know now. It's okay to label myself that, even if it's just a short time label, because the fact that I've already come to terms with that is more than I could ever wish for. So it was less about like really nailing down the identity and more about just accepting that I had a different identity.
And was this during college that this coming out happened?
Such an unfortunate thing too. It's like, God, couldn't I just be gay like in college, openly gay, so I could have a little bit more fun in that realm? Like the idea of questioning your sexuality in college is so annoying, because you miss out on so much potential fun that you could have because you're just all caught up in your head. So yeah, it was the major kind of tipping point was during my 2 years at university here in Minnesota, or there in Minnesota.
Yeah. I was going to say St. John's, correct?
St. John's, all boys. See, again, also all boys school. There's a, you know, normally that's a little, like someone would say that's a little bit heavenly. That's a little bit perfect, but nope, not at all.
I was going to say, I don't associate that part of the state, kind of rural east of St. Cloud, as being, you know, exactly the Castro. Like it's not the most happening gay spot in the world, I would think.
I met up with some college friends the other day. They were visiting LA. They were visiting town. So we got drinks and dinner. And we were just talking about college as one does. But someone brought up some like this is to your point. Someone brought up like, did you know that our college had an armory? And I said, come again? And they're like, well, you know, obviously it's a hunting state, so people want to bring their guns to school. And I'm like, first off, what the fuck? Second off, keep going. And they said, so you could bring your guns to school, and they had to store them all in the same area. And it just happened to be sort of like a little underground room where they stored like half the student body's shotguns. And I'm like, that is terrifying, that is so normal. And that I also was not made aware of that as a student at this school, that we had a fucking armory.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Bring your Bob Marley poster. Bring your ski equipment, bring your bong, and bring your shotgun. That's college.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's the American way, for sure.
So I'm sensing a kind of revolutionary era here when you're 20, 21 years old, of leaving college and coming out.
Revolutionary. As soon as I got access to that armory, I started the revolution, for sure.
It's the most fabulous revolution you've ever seen.
We painted them all pink.
Did you drop out and come out at the same time?
It was a whirlwind of a life change. So I started becoming really popular online about 2 years into my college experience. I moved to LA for a summer because I had a friend who had an internship here, and I was like, cool, I'm becoming popular. Like, LA for the summer, that sounds like the perfect time. You know, we can make content, it'd be great. Maybe I'll become more popular. Maybe I'll become a young little starlet, who knows? And we got here, and it actually worked. Like, it actually either was circumstance or what have you. Maybe it was actually a product of being in LA, but that's when everything started hitting. Really, I went from like 100,000 subscribers to 500,000 to a million, all within the same like 6 months period. And I just never left. I never went back to school. I had to have some hard conversations with parents and friends and siblings of, you may not understand this, but I know it's the right thing to do. And I just never looked back. But again, in that time period as well, I was also trying to figure out my identity as a human, while becoming increasingly more in the spotlight and people increasingly wanting to know more about my identity, but I didn't even have the real answers. So in a way, I was projecting a false representation of who I was very loudly to the entire world, or what it felt like at the time. And it became like an increasing number of lies. So I started feeling worse and worse that I wasn't fully representing myself. And people were, the people were coming in, the people were asking more questions. And I felt like I started becoming less and less of myself. And it all kind of, again, hit a tipping point.
It was like a performance thing? You were playing a character named Connor Franta, but that wasn't the actual person?
See, I think at the time, I thought I was playing Connor Franta most of the time. And then I didn't realize how much of an act it was. And even when I did realize it was, somewhat of a lie, I would convince myself that it wasn't a lie, that it was just like a fabrication of the truth. I don't know, like something that I would convince myself that I'd be like, no, it's not lying. It's just, it's not the truth fully. I don't, you know what I mean? Like I wasn't acting.
But. Wouldn't stand up in court perhaps, but for YouTube, it could play along for a little while.
Listen, I'm a great liar. You have no idea how I can stand up in court. How dare you?
What were some of the lies? How were you portraying yourself in a dishonest way, or at least in a way that was omitting key ingredients?
Oh, I mean, just the simplest things down to like me talking about how happy I was and how much of a good time I was having. And then I would, finish my edit and my friends would be going to a party and I'd be like, I can't, I don't really want to go. And then I just kind of like curl up in a ball in my room because I was so anxious and depressed and like didn't want to be around people. Or like little things like, hey, this is what I like about a girl. And I would make videos about what I like about girls when I clearly knew that these were honestly, it was like I was picturing a man and saying what I like about a man, but attributing it to a female, to a woman. So it's like telling you, doing that constantly again in front of like a growing audience has really negative, heavy effects on your mind.
It's funny. I watched one of those videos, but it was part of a video where you were saying, I used to do this and, this isn't who I actually was, but this is what I did. And so I had that knowledge going into it, but still, the dead-eyed quality of here's what I like in a girl, like the
painful.
The soul has already been snapped into, but he keeps on talking.
Oh my God. I know. So painful.
Here's a clip from the video I'm talking about. Connor Franta in 2013 talking about what he looks for in a girl.
I obviously like girls that are cute, have a good personality. Who doesn't? A unique thing is I like a girl who has a good sense of style, how to wear her clothes and all that stuff. Can't be generic now, can you? Or whatever. I also really like a girl who's kind of sassy with me, if that makes sense. Like, she's not afraid to joke around, poke my buttons, make me a little bit angry, a little bit playful and all that stuff. It's always kind of fun because I enjoy doing that. Of course, since I'm an athlete, I look for a girl that's fit, not necessarily athletic. Like, as long as she likes to exercise and is pretty fit, I'm pretty sure we'll get along pretty well. Pretty, 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 pretty. And finally, I look for a girl that's a little artsy. Me being on YouTube and creating, Me being on YouTube and like creating YouTube content and all that stuff, I like to be creative and just do stuff with my hands.
Connor recently made a new video where he watched that video and was intensely mortified. Coming up, California sunshine and rapid success are nice, but can they cure all mental health problems? The answer may not surprise you. It's no. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
I want to ask about the coming to California then, because it was a sort of double twist ending of, like, I went out there thinking that I'd make it big, and I was kind of waiting for, and then nothing worked. But then I was like, and I did. It was wonderful. So were you having continued mental health problems even though you had that success, even though you were getting all those subscribers?
I think that it was a storm of, it was a perfect distraction from my reality, in that it was really wonderful. It was so unexpected. It was incredibly confusing but amazing at the same time. So I was able to not think about all the problems I was having for most of the day, most of the time. But then in classic young emo child ways, I would shut my bedroom door at night and be left to my own thoughts and devices. And that's when I would remember all of the trauma that I was going through, or all of, like, the heavy experiences that I was thinking about. Is always, again, when you shut that bedroom door at night and you're left to your own mind, it'll bring you back to your reality very quickly.
And not to put you back in that room, but tell us what that's like. Like, the door closes, you're left with that thought process. What's going on?
It was like there was a vignette around me at you know, all hours of the night. It was like my mind was plagued with a storm of thoughts, of expectations from other people. It was always like a worry of, this will change everything. This will change everything about what everyone thought about me, about my future. Everyone will think I was lying to them. And it would just plague my mind in constant whispers back and forth, where I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't relax. And, you know, again, as soon as I stopped keeping myself busy, I would my mind would just light up and at night by myself. And it was just, you know, exhausting.
And by this point, how many years had you been doing these videos? How long had you been making them?
So at that point, I'd been making them for about 3 to 4 years. I started when I was 17.
Okay. Did you have then some boundaries set up around, you know, here is Connor the entertainer, here is Connor the brand that you're earning your living by, versus here I am as a private person, you know, like, because I think the idea of that kind of exposure and that many people talking about you and perhaps feeling like they know you, that's got to be disorienting.
I think it was at a time when the internet was, or at least social media in general, was so, it was in its infant stages. It was so new and budding that we as creators didn't even know that that was something we should be thinking about. And I think I was young enough at the time too that I didn't know that I would want boundaries later on in my life. I think it's really fun when you're a young person and everyone wants to know everything about you and you feel like you're the popular kid. You feel like you're perfectly unique and interesting, maybe for the first time in your life. I know for me, it was definitely the first time I was like, oh, wow, I'm interesting. I'm unique.
Popular.
People want to know a lot about me. That's crazy. I'll give them everything they want. That's amazing that they just want to know. But yeah, you start to realize the more you do it or the older you get that that's not a healthy thing in any relationship to give everything of yourself, nor is it something that's lasting. It'll drain you pretty quickly of your autonomy.
How did you do with the people who I imagine were getting on and trolling you? Hey, Connor, you suck, you know? Like, did that cut deep?
I never had too much trolling, but it's crazy how in a sea of positivity, one negative comment will sink your entire ship. And it will fester in your mind for hours on end. Just one little critique, whether it's ridiculous or not, it will eat you alive. And honestly, myself and a lot of my online friends to this day, that's still our major issue. It's hard to overlook that one negative. It's almost like it's worse than a sea of negative comments than to get one really bad one amongst a sea of good ones. Because you're like, well, why aren't you like the rest of them? Why don't you love me like the rest of them, Johnny? Fuck.
Yeah, I run into that with book reviews all the time. Where like,
painful.
I know if I walk into that part of town, I'm going to find at least one person and they're just going to get at me.
Oh, I read one about my book the other day and I was like, damn, you didn't hold back. Oh my God. I was like, I can't imagine. That's the thing too. And the older I've gotten, I'm like, I can't imagine being so critical of a stranger in any case, even if it's, you know, like a really famous movie, a really famous book, you know, an author in any way. I can't imagine being so critical of them publicly.
Like, yeah. Going through all the effort.
Yeah. It feels like, and you put yourself in that negative space too, to be so critical that I feel bad for the person leaving that comment because it sounds like they don't have a lot going on.
My line I often use with people like that, and it is so patronizing, is I always say, well, I hope they find the help that they need.
I do the same thing.
It's such a dick thing for me to say, but it just gives me a lot of satisfaction. Yeah, they must hurt. They must have a lot of pain.
They're so jealous. It must be painful to be that jealous of little old me. I know, whatever it is that gets you to sleep at night. But they say, like, especially for not just books, but like Amazon reviews in general, like you never go on Amazon to give like a perfectly mediocre review. It's either all praise or all criticism. So if you're looking, I think that is for a lot of review websites in general. It's like no one's going on there to give a perfectly flavorless review. They either want it to be over or under.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've hosted it's being revived now, a comedy variety show called Wits. And we would do a whole bit with one-star Amazon reviews of things that are indisputably classics. Like yes. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. This is terrible. Because there's so many characters behind those reviews. The person who... It's an acting challenge. I want to get on the timeline here again a little bit. So you're in LA. Your popularity is booming. You have everything you want. You're closing the door and imploding emotionally because some of these issues are catching up with you. What do you do about it? What's next? What's your move from there?
It was such a whirlwind because when I moved here and I think it was like... God, I'm trying to remember if it was, I think it was a year and a half later is when I came out. So it was a relatively quick, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a year and a half. Yeah, I think it was a year and a half. Or was it even quicker than that? It might have even been quicker. Either way, it was very quick. Like it was all of a sudden like being exposed to a more diverse group of people, to a larger population, meeting people.
people, hearing about their experiences, I just realized how humanity is a spectrum, and that's not new news, that's not old news, that's not something to be afraid of. And as soon as I saw it with my own eyes, people being openly themselves in the streets, you know, men holding hands with men, women kissing women, meeting, you know, my first transgender person, meeting my first drag queen, like any of that, I was like, oh, it's not that scary. People are doing it right in front of my eyes. It's fine. Like they seem to be fine. This is fine. And as soon as that clicked in my brain, it was relatively, you know, nothing. And I began my process of coming out and coming out to one person and two people and three people and then the entire internet within a whole year. It was very quick.
Were you confident when you came out on the internet that it was also going to be fine, that people were going to have that same reaction?
I think I was blissfully ignorant in the best possible way, because I was asked that so often around that time of like, weren't you worried that your audience of teenage girls were going to leave you because you no longer were like a heartthrob or obtainable in terms of dating to them or any of that? And I'm like, no, I didn't even think about that. Don't, what do you mean? That was a possibility? That was an option? What?
Yeah. Yeah. And so then what did that do for the depression, the anxiety, these other mental health factors that you had going on?
So it was I was temporarily alleviated of the depression and anxiety for a moment there. But then because it's not like it was fully attached to that identity, it almost became an identity of its own. Years later, I realized, oh no, it's still here. And it's actually worse than ever because I've never fully dealt with it. So then I began the process. Yeah, about 2 years after I came out, 3 years after I came out, of then figuring out what depressed Connor was, what anxiety Connor was.
How did you figure that out?
Yeah, you know, the hard way, as one does. Usually when you really hit an unexpected pitfall or an unexpected downward spiral, you think, well, there's got to be a way not to go back here. And I was in such like a heavy pit of depression and anxiety for so long that I started doing what everyone said, like get a therapist, ask your therapist about medication, ask how never to get back here, and like begin that process only because that's what people told me to do or I heard people talking about. If no one like talked about it, so if this was, you know, the 80s, and no one was talking about going to therapy, I don't know what I would have done. I probably, jokes aside, would have like become an alcoholic or become a drug addict or turned to something other than professional help, because that, you know, it's become very well talked about and almost trendy to talk about your therapist in a way. So I think I'm fortunate to have been in this time.
In California, it's cultural too. So then did you find a good one right away? Did you find a match right away, or was there some trial and error with therapy?
I did. I think I either have luck on my side or I'm a Virgo who chooses really well. Because I got my therapist match, still with my same therapist to this day, was recommended by a friend, a therapist, and I've liked her ever since.
Wow. That's yeah. Very fortunate.
It's very rare.
Yeah.
I've come to learn that.
Yeah, yeah. You've been making videos through the whole thing, and I can't imagine that you ever would say, like, okay, I'm going to take me at my worst and put me on display here. But that's also a truth of part of who you are and who you were. How did you manage those decisions about what version of yourself to put out there that would feel honest to you but is also palatable to the world?
I didn't realize it at the time, but it's not normal, nor is it okay to put on some sort of false facade or to fake your emotions when you're trying to be your authentic self on camera. So I would frequently have to film a video, or I would frequently feel like I needed to film a video, and I would just pretend to be totally okay. It would be like turning on the camera and going from wiping tears away to an instant smile. And I was beginning to perform to just get myself through my job. And after doing that for a few years, I realized how wrong that is, or how unhealthy, I guess, that is. And then I started
allowing myself to, if I was having some sort of off week or if I was having, you know, a depressive week, I would either not film or I would find a way to incorporate those emotions into the video, sometimes, you know, including the verbiage or sometimes just more filming something that isn't me pretending to be the happiest I've ever been in my life.
Hmm. It seems to me, and you know, I'm a generation older than you, so it's not as native to my thinking, but it seems like you have this, it seems like a kind of journaling, you know, like to keep a record of what you're doing is very healthy. To keep a record of where your emotional state is, your mental state is, very healthy. It's not often recommended traditionally to then let millions of strangers view that. And so how do you walk that line?
It's a weird cycle, the, you know, the social media game that everyone's playing now. And in a way, me and my friends, we were all kind of like the guinea pigs of it. No one knew that it wasn't that, like, that was unhealthy or that was unhealthy behavior to just keep posting your way through a depressive episode or to then that's a nuanced conversation, but to monetize your pain. I have conflicted feelings with that as well, even though, you know, I just released a book that monetized my depression. So, you know, order your copy today. But there's a lot of nuance to that conversation. I'm a little bit conflicted about it. And at the time, it totally seemed like the only way to move forward. I mean, at the end of the day, these bills got to be paid, the audience needs to be fed, or they'll move on to someone else. And that was like a sad reality where you felt like you were pigeonholed, or you're kind of, in a way, like a slave to the algorithm or to the schedule that you put yourself in. It used to be so liberating. I can upload whatever I want, whenever I want. But now all of a sudden, you have to do it or you die.
Wow. I'm not sure that's literally true, but...
hey, you don't know.
I don't know. No, again, this is all new to me.
More with Connor Franta just ahead. No surprise, I suppose, but one of the most popular videos on Connor's YouTube is the one where he comes out to his viewers. Here's part of that one.
2014 is truly the year that I have accepted who I am and become happy with that person. So today, I want to talk to you guys about that and be open and honest and tell you that I'm gay. And this may come as a shock to a lot of you, and it may be confusing, so I'm gonna backtrack a little bit. Growing up, I always knew I was a little bit different than everyone else. I always just had this feeling that I wasn't the same. But it wasn't until I was 12 years old until I really had pinpointed what that was. For some reason, my seventh grade year, I had this thought in the back of my head, what if I'm gay? And I immediately was so terrified.
You're in a theater. The lights go down. You're about to get swept up by the characters and all their little details and interpersonal dramas. You look at them and think, that person is so obviously in love with their best friend. Wait, am I in love with my best friend? That character's mom is so overbearing. Why doesn't she just stand up to her? Oh God, do I need to stand up to my own mother? If you've ever recognized yourself in a movie, then join me, Jordan Cruciola, for the podcast Feeling Seen. We've talked to author Susan Orlean on realizing her own marriage was falling apart after watching Adaptation, an adaptation of her own work, and comedian Hari Kondabolu on why Harold and Kumar was a depressingly important movie for Southeast Asians. So join me every Thursday for the Feeling Seen podcast here on Maximum Fun.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller.
9 years ago, we started a podcast to try and learn something new every episode.
Things have gone a little off the rails since then. Tune in to hear about
low-stakes neighborhood drama,
gardening,
the sordid, nasty underbelly of the horse girl lifestyle,
hot sauce,
addiction to TV and sweaty takes on celebrity culture,
and the weirdest, grossest stuff you can find on Wikipedia.org.
We'll read all of it, no matter how gross. There's something for everyone on our podcast, Baby Geniuses.
Hosted by us, two horny adult idiots.
Hang out with us as we try and fail to retain any knowledge at all.
Every other week on Maximum Fun. Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
Back with Connor Franta, and now that we've heard about his life up to this point, I asked how he was doing with his mental health today.
I have found balance in most of it. I definitely, you know, have down days or down weeks here and there, but by no means am I anywhere. I'm miles away from what I was years ago. And I think that only occurred because I put in the time, I put in the effort, and I had the desire to get better and to figure out what would make me better. And I think that I've, in a way, mastered that for myself. It's not like a one-size-fits-all situation, but for me, I think I know how I tick pretty dang well, and I know how to not become depressed and how to get myself out of it if I am in it.
I'm so glad you used the terminology of putting in the work, because that's what so many people don't realize, that, you know, and I had been to therapists, and I kind of expected to go in there and get fixed, you know, like I was a car. For me, only when I started saying, okay, I should be exhausted by the end of a therapy session. Like, it should be an intense workout. And when I was able to get to that, that's when you learn the skills of managing it, you know, because you know how it operates.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, it takes a lot of willpower as well. You have to want to get better. And that definitely shines through just by going to therapy. There's a willingness to get better. By talking about it to strangers, there's a desire to be better, to be air quotes normal in some way. And you really have to want it. Like, no one can make you do that. No one can just, again, you can't go to therapy and they'll snap their fingers and you're better. You have to put in the time and the effort.
Yeah. There's a reason that the laying on the couch only happens in the cartoon. You know, you have to sit up because you got to do some work.
I know. It feels so good to lay down, though.
No, there's plenty of time for laying down. God knows. So do you consider it now like something that is just part of you that's going to be there from now on that you have to manage?
I this is also kind of a new phase that I find myself in, and there's a little bit of nuance to this. I think for a while I identified as a depressed person or an anxious person, but the more I walk with my depression, or the more that I understand it, I should say, I more would love to identify moving forward as a person who has experienced depression or a person with anxiety. I never want it to define my humanness before my humanness. And that seems to be something that myself and a lot of people get caught up in, is like, is almost making it your whole identity. Whereas, like, I want to remind people, you don't want this. You don't want it. You definitely, like, it's
no
very
one chose
normal people
this.
Have it. No, and like, ideally you'll find a way to almost not have it. Yeah. It's not that easy, but it's definitely possible to not make it your defining factor.
Well, that's in line with the person first terminology, school of thinking, that, you know, that you don't say Tom is schizophrenic. Tom is a person with schizophrenia. You know, I've often struggled, and I've been doing shows like this for many years now. I tend to settle on someone who has dealt with depression. You know,
yes.
Connor has dealt with depression. There's nothing implicit that he won't do it more in the future, you know, but he's had to deal, you know, it's something that he's encountered. You do a lot of work with awareness of advocacy, of fighting stigma, getting these conversations out in the open, very much in line with what we're doing here on this show. Why do you think those conversations are still so daunting for people? I mean, I think we've come a long way, but it's still daunting for a lot of people to openly discuss mental health.
I think it's just because there's many things, but I think that it's because there's no clear one way to get out of it. So it's a very foggy path to walk down and to admit that you're on, because there's no clear ending to it. And also, there's just so many stigmas associated with having poor mental health that people never want to be seen as weak. And in, I guess, like a traditional masculine society, no one ever wants to be seen as vulnerable or weak. And admitting that you're struggling in any way, but especially in a way that isn't visible most of the times, just feels so fictional. And I can see why people who aren't incredibly progressive or incredibly in tune with how, like, the human experience works, that it just feels like you're complaining, or it just feels like you're not manly enough. So I think that there are so many societal norms that just need to be torn down and reassembled.
When you make videos, when you write books, your latest book is House Fires, are you keeping that in mind of like, okay, I've got a lot of eyes on me. I got a lot of people listening to me. How can I guide this society as best I can from this platform to something better?
Without a doubt, it almost is difficult at times because I'm trying to be so inclusive with my language and so, it's not even that I'm trying to be perfectly forward thinking, but I'm always so aware of how my words come across and who they're coming across to. There's, you know, such a gradient of people that watch me that I want to make everyone feel seen and everyone feel heard in the right ways. And in a way, it's like it almost makes me unrelatable, I think, because I try to be so perfect in that way. But it also is the correct way of speaking. So I never know how to dabble. But at the end of the day, it's just, you know, I want everyone to feel seen and heard and comfortable and validated.
Yeah. Do you feel all those eyes on you when you do your work?
Yes, not as much anymore. I think I've gotten to a place where I understand it, and you know, you can control it since I still edit everything that I do. I still shoot everything that I do, so I have a lot of control. Whereas if I was sending it out or if I was a part of some big production, I would be afraid more that something would get misinterpreted or put out without my permission. But because I control everything that I do, I'm much more relaxed with it.
Is that a conscious thing that you want to keep that control as opposed to, like, you know, BuzzFeed calls and offers you a big salary to go do it with them? You want to keep it yourself?
Connor's therapist has entered the chat. I thoroughly enjoy control. But I think part of it, too, is that I enjoy the creativity that comes with the edit. And I think that's where my style has been created and mastered in a way, is through the production or the post-production of everything that I create, whether it be a book, a podcast, a YouTube video, any of it. I think that what makes me is through the after work that I put into all of it. So I could never release that control because I truly don't think it would be me anymore. I enjoy it too much, the fluidity of that creativity.
So presumably there's a lot of young people in small towns in similar situations to where you were not all that long ago. What would you tell yourself back then? Go back and give yourself a sentence of advice back then.
To avoid cliches or to avoid things that I've said in the past in a way, I think I just want everyone to be, or I would tell myself to be more aware of everything around you and everyone around you and how your actions, your words, your experience can affect the people in your bubble, in your circle, in your reality. So it's to be less blissfully ignorant and to be more socially aware, because that's where my greatest growth has occurred, is when I start thinking outside myself and more about the greater good or the greater whole of humanity.
You can find more about Connor Franta by visiting google.com and typing in his name. I thought about what Kate said in the intro about relatability. One of the most popular videos on Connor's YouTube channel is one of the first ones he made. It's cringy, it's relatable, and here's some of it.
Yeah, and then I just hopped grad parties and went to a movie with some friends. We hit up that movie Bridesmaids. I know what you're thinking. Chick flick, gross, you're a homosexual, gay, blah, blah, blah. Shut up. It was really funny. I'm not even gonna lie, like, that movie was hilarious. You need to go see it, no matter what you are, girl or boy or whatever, I don't care, adult or child, it's hilarious. There's just so many funny one-liners in that movie.
All right, well, let's take a little rest for your brain here. Let's get you reset and refreshed and centered. I don't know exactly what kind of verbs to choose here, but we're going to have a meditation moment with our friend Laura House. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
Laura is, of course, the co-host of the Tiny Victories podcast. And joins us for some meditation moments. What verbs do you like? I'm thinking reset, refreshed, presented. I don't know.
Let go.
Yeah.
Black out. I mean, if it's a good one, if you can really just.
Yeah. Just lose yourself.
Lose yourself. Yeah. If you can just. Yeah.
Surrender to the flow.
I kind of like when they're non-typical meditation-y words. Like, I kind of like the idea of boss up.
Like, oh, nice.
There's something kind of great about meditation in a rebellious way of like, what are we supposed to do all day? Work and worry. Like, that's culturally what we're told to do. So meditation is like what a boss does, like hold my calls.
Oh, right.
So right. I feel like that's a fun flex for meditation where you don't, and sometimes we're not in the mood to be like serene and chill, and we don't want to feel like a Bambi, and we're just like, you know what? I'm going to boss up. Like, this is my time. So,
right. Let's boss up. All right.
Is that even a term?
Let's level up. Like, I think of like Pac-Man eating the fruit and then suddenly being able to devour ghosts.
Nice. Yeah. Good thought. Okay. So all we do is first thing, get comfortable, get in a seat, be somewhere you can close your eyes safely. So not driving. Just get comfortable in your chair, your sofa or whatever. Just close your eyes. You've already done the hard part, which is sitting down to do it. And then just notice your breath. Just very lightly become aware that your breath is happening. And you're going to have thoughts, and we're not trying to get rid of thoughts. Just when you are aware of your thoughts, just notice your breath again. Just be kind of drifty. You can go ahead and open your eyes slowly. It's always amazing to me how just even a couple of moments of like shifts, like, oh, you really stop thinking about whatever it was.
Well, and you could stay present. I mean, it's about staying present, but you can do it such that it's not like you're going into a coma. Like, you're still part of the world. You're still engaged with the world as it is. Yeah. I mean, nothing against deep sleep. We all like that.
Yeah, but it is. It's an awake sleep. It is sort of sometimes called that. And yeah, it's just that letting go of the stuff. I feel like even it's productive when you're not doom scrolling and you're just like, oh, eyes closed. There's my breath. Oh, good. It's like, oh, good. No bad news. We're checked out. And you bossed up.
Right. If you could find time for doom scrolling, you could certainly find time to row your boat the other way.
Yeah. Carve a minute out of the doom scroll.
If our listeners haven't heard Tiny Victories yet, tell us a little bit about what Tiny Victories is. What can they expect when they tune in?
Oh, Tiny Victories, for one, it's a 15-minute podcast, so easy to fit in. It's a little sort of burst of joy from a couple of cynical comics, I guess, is one way to put it. So it's not all goody-goody, but I do it with Annabelle Gurwitch, who's a New York Times bestselling author, which is exciting. And we celebrate minor accomplishments and fleeting joys. So the kind of stuff that your brain says, oh, that's not a big deal. We're like, your button came off and you sewed it back on that day. I mean,
celebrate that.
I mean, that's a David and Goliath of, that's a, like a thing you don't do for 2 years and then you just throw the whole shirt away. So we're like, it's a big deal. So we look at that and there's a whole spectrum of, you know, how big a deal they are. But we look at the tiny victories and have fun with them.
Tune into Tiny Victories. Find more about Laura at laurahouse.com. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Next time on Depresh Mode, she was a headline around the world, a gossip item, a true crime figure, an Italian prisoner, and a wrongful conviction. But Amanda Knox is also a person.
If I touch on something that you'd rather not get into, just say so. We'll cut the whole exchange out. But it also seems like you're pretty open about a lot of things.
Yeah. I am having trouble imagining anything that you could talk to me about. I know.
What are we going to throw Amanda Knox with?
If people support our show through a small donation, we can keep being here together. If not, we can't. If you donate already, thank you. You are making Depression Mode happen. You're helping yourself and others. If you haven't donated yet, it's easy. Find a level that works for you at MaximumFun.org/join. Hey, I wrote a book called The Hilarious World of Depression. It's a memoir. It's about me and mental health and life, and there are jokes in it. The Hilarious World of Depression is available where books are sold. You could try buying it where garden hoses are sold, but I don't think that's going to work out. Be sure to hit subscribe on Depression Mode, give us 5 stars, write reviews. That helps people find out about the show. We would love to get some more sounders from you, that little positive plug at the end of the show from listeners. Record on your voice message app, electric mail it to us. DepressionMode@MaximumFun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies, and join us there. Great conversation happening over there. We're on Twitter at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. Hello, credits listeners. The Chinese New Year is only a couple weeks away, and 2022 is the year of the tiger. So please report to the nearest post office and pick up your free tiger. Just a little service from the government to you. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
I'm Anna from Canada, and I'm glad you're still here.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.